Oh, welcome everyone. This is a session on the SWAG years, revolutionary organising in the 1970s. So sort of fitting with the general commemoration of the late 60s, early 70s period of radicalism. Tess will be giving the introduction today. She is a long-term political activist and she was a student at Monash University in the 1970s. She was a teachers' union delegate after this for over 30 years. She just told me she's happily retired now. She was a founding member of the Marxist Workers Group, Socialist Workers Action Group, International Socialist and Socialist Alternative. She's also worked editing on the Red Flag and Marxist Left Review. Before I hand over to Tess to regale us with her wonderful stories of being a student radical at Monash in particular, I want to encourage you to register for a new political project of the left, which is the Victorian Socialists. Apparently they have already surpassed the figure that they need to register as a political party in Victoria, which is 500, but they want to obviously get a lot more than that to really sort of entrench their deserved place in Victorian electoral politics. So I really encourage anyone who hasn't done so to register for the party. There is a stall out at the registration desk, I think more stalls over as well near the bar. So anyone who hasn't done that and you're a resident of Victoria, I really encourage you to help the Victorian Socialist project for the upcoming election. So without further ado, I will hand it over to Tess to get things started.
Thanks, Leanne. So the Socialist Workers Action Group, or SWAG as we called ourselves, was a key precursor organisation of Socialist Alternative. It was a small organisation. It existed only in Melbourne and only for 3 years, from November 1972 till December 75. And at that point, a modest regroupment conference gave birth to the International Socialists. Now, SWAG's membership never topped 30. And today, three members of SWAG are in Socialist Alternative: Mick Armstrong, Tom Allington, and myself, who I'm happy to say are all present today. And Janie Stone was also a member of SWAG, and I have to thank her for supplying some of the photos and scans that I'll be using today. I've also put up a display of memorabilia for people to have a look at later. So I'm going to start with a little bit of historical context, because the political climate back at the time I'm talking about was vastly different from the circumstances in which we operate today. And just to give a bit of the flavour of the times, I want to play the start of a song that was a hit song from 1969. It's called Something in the Air by Thunderclap Newman. I bought this single back in 1969. Some people remember it. So internationally, as you'd be aware, it was a period of mass radicalisation across the world based on events such as the Vietnam War, May 68 in France, the struggle against apartheid in South Africa, the civil rights movement in the US, huge cataclysmic struggles that were taking place around the world. There was the so-called youth rebellion and there was the emergence of a radical student movement. Things like the contraceptive pill gave women an unprecedented level of control over their fertility, and this fed into a sexual revolution which transformed the norms of sexual behaviour and challenged gender stereotypes. So all that was happening around the world and in Australia, and in Australia as well, workers' living standards were rising and so were their expectations. Union membership was strong and a number of key unions were led or strongly influenced by socialists. So there was a very high level of working class combativity, as those of you who went to Liz Ross's talk yesterday would know about. So it was such a tumultuous time that it really wasn't that unreasonable to think, as a lot of us did, that if the revolution wasn't actually here, like it says in the song, it was just around the corner. And for those who already identified as socialist, Russia's invasion of Czechoslovakia in 1968 fed into increasing disenchantment with the existing left forces. The Communist Party was fracturing. The Maoists had already split away in 1964, and now the party was further divided between the hardline Moscow liners and those moving in a more reformist direction. And the hardliners split away in 1971. So all of this opened up the space for the emergence of new left groups, and that's where our story starts. The small forces that became SWAG were a student club at Monash, the Revolutionary Communists, or REVCOMS, and the Marxist Workers Group. And the common element to these two groups was Dave Nadel. He'd been a leading figure on the left since the mid-1960s. And at the time, of course, as many of you would know, Monash was the most radical campus in the country. Now, for a while, Dave had been attracted to the Maoists, who dominated the Monash left and attracted a lot of people. But by the time I met him in early 1970, he was starting to explore Trotskyism. There weren't actually any organised Trotskyists in Melbourne back then. But Dave and his friend Chris Gaffney were influenced by Ted Tripp, who was a long-term Trotskyist who ran Marxism classes at the Victorian Labour College at Trades Hall. So Dave and Chris joined a group aligned with Tripp called the Toxin Group, but they soon developed differences with the other members, and some of these went on to form the Socialist Labour League, which was aligned with Gerry Healy's British group. At the start of 1972, Dave and I, along with Mark Matcott, who did the cartoons, set up the REVCOMS at Monash. We produced a weekly leaflet called Hard Lines, and Mark's brilliant cartoons and our humorous style quickly helped us build an audience. At around the same time, Dave and Chris formed a loose discussion circle called the Marxist Workers Group. The common ideas in this group were anti-Stalinism and a working class orientation. But beyond that, there were widely divergent views, especially between the Nadel-Gaffney-Trotskyist grouping and an anarchist grouping. In early 1972, attendance of the Marxist Workers Group was about between 20 and 30, and there was a very big turnover from week to week. One regular participant was Dave's housemate, Phil Griffiths, who was a student at Melbourne Uni. At the May Day March in 1972, we distributed a leaflet called Kangaroo Capitalism. In this leaflet, we critiqued what we called the Marxist reactionary nationalist philistinism, and their call for an alliance between Australian workers and patriotic bosses against the evils of US imperialism. Now, whatever other differences existed, this was a defining issue for the Marxist Workers Group. And fortuitously, the leaflet caught the attention of a couple of activists who'd recently arrived from the United States, Janie Stone and Tomo Lincoln. This is what they looked like in 1973. Now, Tom and Janie had been members of the International Socialists in the United States. So they started to attend MWG meetings, and their political experience had an immediate impact. Janie also brought her experience of the women's liberation movement in the US. So they both quickly established themselves as leading members of the group. Tom was then a teacher, and he was involved in a rank-and-file group in the union called Teacher Action. So this group argued for militant, democratic and socially conscious unionism. And it was actually quite influential within the left-wing secondary teachers' union. In the middle of 1972, the MWG had a major debate about revolutionary organisation. The Trotskyists argued for a disciplined vanguard party as the model. The anarchist-inclined members maintained that such a party was elitist and would inevitably lead to authoritarianism and Stalinism. And they counterposed the idea of a loose federation. They lost the argument and left. And a few other people, including Chris Gaffney, left around this time. So Tom and Janie now began a conscious intervention to win the group to ISPolitics more generally. A key issue for the left back at the time was the class nature of the Soviet Union, a.k.a. the Russian question. Back then, the ISUS adhered to the theory of bureaucratic collectivism. Dave Nadel held the orthodox Trotskyist position that Russia was a degenerated workers' state. But over time, Tom convinced him and the rest of us that the Soviet Union was a class society. So the slogan, neither Washington nor Moscow, but international socialism, was a key political stance that distinguished us from the rest of the Australian left. In the latter part of 1972, Tom and Jamie set up a faction called Red Ink, and Dave and I joined that as well. And the aim of this was to win the group to Leninist politics and organisation. And the setting up of the faction caused a certain amount of tension in the group. But in practice, the MWG was seeing itself more and more as an activist group rather than a discussion circle, with the idea that members' political activity should be subject to collective discussion and decision-making. So when it was proposed that we put out a regular leaflet aimed at clerical workers, it was given that this would be the responsibility of the group as a whole. So Clark and Dagger was launched in October, using the same sort of humorous style that had made Hard Lines so successful at Monash. Clark and Dagger was essentially an anonymous underground leaflet. It was mostly distributed by student members. The aim was to flush out union militants with a view to establishing rank and file groups in particular workplaces or unions. We handed out 1,000 to 1,500 of these leaflets every fortnight at a dozen or so offices in the CBD. Where possible, we targeted workplaces where a member or a contact worked. Griff by now was working as an insurance clerk, and he soon became the driving force of Clark and Dagger. Janie was already a leading activist in the emerging women's liberation movement in Melbourne, and in 1972 she helped set up the Working Women's Group, which had 10 to 15 members. Here we are. The group published a leaflet called Bread and Roses and ambitiously aimed to organise working women in struggles for equal pay and against sexist discrimination, both in workplaces and within unions. So by late 1972, the Marxist Workers Group, with about 15 regular members, was involved in several unions, a couple of rank and file groups, a women's liberation group, and a highly active student club. And amid all this frantic activism, we were still trying to sort out our political ideas and educate ourselves in Marxist politics. So to this end, Tom initiated what he called a cater development group, which was basically a reading group where we tried to get to grips with the Marxist classics. These sessions took place after the usual lengthy weekly meetings where we discussed our work and the political issues of the day. MWG meetings, comrades nowadays, would often start at around 6:30 and end well after 11. So to say we were hyperactive would be a massive understatement. I mean, it makes me tired just thinking about it. But then we decided to step it up a notch. We weren't doing enough, really. A federal election was due in late 1972, and it was pretty clear Labor was going to win. So we saw this as a good time to start producing our own paper. It took many weeks to prepare and produce the first issue of The Battler, which appeared in November. The paper's name was seemingly somewhat at odds with our hostility to Australian nationalism. But Dave argued that it both reflected the homegrown nature of our group and had a working class underdog sort of flavour. So we went with it. The rationale for the extremely ultra-left headline was that after decades of liberal rule, most workers had illusions in Labor and needed to go through the experience of a Labor government that was subservient to capitalism. We sold the paper at election rallies and at a few militant workplaces. Sold particularly well on the waterfront. And with the launch of The Battler, we decided to change our name to the Socialist Workers Action Group, which had a less student-y and more activist ring to it. There's a picture of us with a banner and a demo. It wasn't just a change of name, though. The Red Ink faction successfully proposed that SWAG become a formal membership group, requiring payment of dues and a commitment to the group's activities. But if 1972 ended on a high, the early months of 1973 brought us down to earth with a thud. Membership dropped to 10, and we decided we didn't have either the degree of political unity or the resources to keep producing the Battler. It was a period of retreat in activist terms, but also of political consolidation and hardening up. In August 73, SWAG held its first conference. By then we had 12 members, and two more contacts joined at the end of the weekend. The conference debated two main issues. First was the question of the Labor Party. Now, I don't have time to go into this in detail, but the group basically adopted the position argued by Dave Nadel, which was an entrenched perspective of working within the Victorian socialist left, with the ultimate aim of splitting it away to form a new socialist party. Couldn't say we weren't ambitious. Second was the structure of the organisation. The Reading faction successfully argued for the election of a political rather than an administrative leadership body, as we'd had up to then. Tom, Dave and Griff were accordingly elected as our first political committee. Reading also argued for a degree of political discipline. That is, members would be expected to argue for the agreed political positions of the group, or at least not to oppose them publicly. With these principles accepted, the Reading faction disbanded and the focus returned to activism. Griff set up a rank and file group in the insurance union called the Militant Insurance Clerks, or MIC, which produced a leaflet called Mickey Finn. Most of our leaflets had puns as headlines, that was Nadel. In 73, Griff was elected to the Victorian Executive of the Union and was able to initiate some general meetings on equal pay. In October, over 2,000 people, insurance clerks, attended a lunchtime rally. And against opposition from the Union Executive, Griff won a vote for strike action. Over 1,000 insurance clerks didn't go back to work that afternoon, and this was the first strike in the union's history. Unfortunately, both the campaign and the MIC group later collapsed. A year earlier in 1972, I'd been elected to the Political Affairs Committee of the Monash Student Association. Mark's election poster probably helped. By now, Hard Lines was far and away the most popular left-wing leaflet, and my position on the PAC gave us a higher profile. So in the 73 elections, I actually received the highest vote of any of the left candidates. We challenged the Maoists to a debate on the question of the road to socialism, and several hundred people turned up to it. We opposed their so-called nationalist road to socialism and argued against class collaboration and popular front strategies. And judging by the response of the audience, we won. So the Maoists responded to this humiliation with a leaflet called Ice Pick, which regurgitated all the Stalinist lies about Trotsky being a fascist agent. But by now, they were pretty much a spent force. And for the next couple of years, we were the leading left force on campus. In late 73, SWAG formally took a position on the Russian question, narrowly adopting the bureaucratic collectivist analysis. A former member of the British IS who'd joined argued unsuccessfully for the state capitalism position, which many of us were hearing for the first time. But the high number of abstentions, it was an indication of our theoretical rawness. In late 73 and early 74, Dave and I separately went overseas and for the first time came into direct contact with the British IS. I was the first to hit London and, somewhat surprisingly, was invited to attend a meeting of its national committee. So I sat in a corner, utterly in awe of being in the presence of Tony Cliff and Paul Foot and all these other luminaries, and most of them didn't know or care who I was and hadn't even heard of SWAG. But there was one notable exception. Chris Harmon came over and asked me who I was. And when I identified myself, he said, SWAG, bureaucratic collectivist, come down the pub. He then proceeded to harangue me several hours about state capitalism. It was a somewhat shattering but highly educational experience. Both Dave and I returned to Australia in early 1974, extremely impressed by the British IS. Dave agitated to resume publication of a newspaper. Now, there was a lot of consideration, trepidation about this, given our previous experience. but it was agreed we'd aim to do so later in the year. And in the meantime, we'd develop our ideas by publishing a modest journal containing analytical and theoretical articles, as opposed to the agitational ones in our various leaflets. So in May, the first edition of Frontline appeared, and we put out two more issues that year. Now, the circulation of Frontline was tiny, probably about 50 copies per issue. But one article in issue number 3 was to prove influential well beyond our own ranks, and that was Janie's analysis of the politics of radical feminism. And that's been reprinted in anthologies of writings on women's liberation in Australia. So in Frontline, we staked out the ground for our stance on key issues. The Russian question and hostility to socialism, the need for union militancy and rank and file groups to challenge the union bureaucracy, and adherence to Leninist principles of organisation. In late 1973, Swag had recruited two students from La Trobe, where the Maoists were still very much dominant. And in 1974, they set up the La Trobe Rev Coms and published a leaflet called Red Ink. Now I've got Lenin and Trotsky on the back. In August 1974, we debated whether or not to proceed with publishing a regular paper. There were still very strong reservations given our very meagre resources, but we eventually decided to go ahead. Meanwhile, things were hotting up out at Monash. We were leading a campaign on assessment, which culminated in mid-September in a week-long occupation of the administration building. This was the first occupation at Monash for several years and the longest that had ever taken place there. Swag held a meeting in the occupied building, attracting a number of students who were impressed by the RevComs. The occupation ended when the admin called in the cops and had 74 of us arrested. The assessment campaign only won a few minor reforms, but for Swag, it was a massive success. 10 people joined in the space of 3 weeks, taking our membership from 14 to 24. The new recruits were mostly Monash students, but two La Trobe students also joined as a result of the occupation. Along with the RevComs at La Trobe, they'd organised a solidarity sit-in by about 50 students in the University Council Chamber. One of them was this young man, who was soon playing a leading role in Swag. Not surprisingly. Just before the occupation, we'd moved into our first proper centre in the city. It had 3 rooms, including one large enough to hold meetings, and space to produce the paper. So the second battler, number one, appeared on October the 19th. This time there was actually a number two. The paper was a monthly 8-pager. We printed 1,000 copies and usually sold around 700. Mostly at demonstrations, Janie was an outstanding seller at demonstrations, but also outside selected blue-collar workplaces, ones with a record of militancy, or where there'd been recent industrial action, or where we had contact on the inside. Now, most of these sales were pretty low, but at a few, we did have regular sales of between 20 and 30. We also did door-to-door sales in Housing Commission areas on weekends. That was fun. In late 1974, some Swag members in the Commonwealth Public Service initiated a rank-and-file group called Servants for Action, which published a leaflet called SFA. Can you imagine what that stands for? So, at the end of that year, 74, we had clubs at Monash and La Trobe. We were producing the Battler monthly, Clark and Dagger fortnightly. We were involved in 3 union rank-and-file groups, all with their own publications. Labor Party activity by now was becoming more sporadic, partly because the socialist left was disintegrating, and partly because most members weren't seriously committed to Dave's entrism strategy. Every member was usually involved in several of these areas of activity, so a high level of commitment was required. But the hyperactivity also meant that burnout was a constant danger. Towards the end of the year, Dave initiated a debate about the Battler. He argued that it should be an agitational vehicle oriented to the blue-collar working class and, in particular, militant shop stewards. The Battler's role should be as the organiser of the most militant section of the class. Now, for a group of 25, this was a totally unrealistic perspective. But while the student movement was in decline, the working class was still on the offensive. Between 1972 and 74, strike days trebled from 2 to more than 6 million. So there was a sense of urgency based on the belief that huge class confrontations were on the agenda. And on that basis, most of us accepted Dave's arguments about the paper. Okay, then in early 1975, along with this sort of perspective, Griffith successfully proposed that our tiny group split into three branches. One based on Monash Doveton, one on La Trobe West Heidelberg, and one on Sunshine Braybrook. These were all the areas where we sold the Battler door to door. The idea was that we would implant ourselves in these working class communities, not just selling the paper, but getting involved in local disputes, attending local ALP branch meetings, and so on. The core of the Monash Revcoms had all graduated at the end of 74, so the work there went into steep decline. The La Trobe Revcoms had to contend with the Maoist penchant for physical violence against their political opponents. They attacked Mick at the equivalent of the NUS conference, and on one occasion went on a rampage and overturned our campus store. In March 75, we had a swag conference where we voted to begin publishing a rank-and-file broadsheet aimed at metal industry workers. We also had another debate about the Russian question. The bureaucratic collectivist analysis was reaffirmed, but there was by this time growing support for the state capitalist position. Then, for a few months, debate raged over the future of Clark and Dagger. Many members were very attached to it, but it had to be conceded that it had failed to find union militants or to recruit people to SWAG. And now that we were producing the Battler, it was a serious drain on our time and resources. Eventually, the decision to drop it was almost unanimous, but the debate was debilitating. Following this conference, Tom and Janie went overseas for 7 months, which significantly reduced the group's leadership and resources. We were also experiencing severe financial difficulties. So it was hardly surprising that a certain amount of demoralisation set in. Then a major internal crisis erupted. One of our leading members, Anne McHugh, was feeling burnt out and wanted to take a leave of absence. Well, that was fine, but it was expected that members on leave of absence would not engage in political activity. But Anne wanted to use her freed-up time to build SFA without being responsible to SWAG, and this was not acceptable to the group. The upshot was that both Anne and her partner Bob, who was also a leading member, resigned. So our membership was down to about 20, and the demoralisation deepened. Griff had quit his job and returned to university, but faced with this crisis in SWAG, he dropped out of uni to become our first permanent full-timer. We couldn't afford to pay him, of course, so he lived on the dole, and it was mainly he and Dave who held the group together in this time. Then things looked up a bit with the prospect of a fusion of revolutionary groupings. There was a group called the Melbourne Revolutionary Marxists who approached SWAG about holding regroupment discussions. We were also in regular contact with a socialist in Hobart, Rana Roy. He was a supporter of the British IS. At the age of 14, he joined the ALP and rapidly gained a following among the left. By the age of 16, he was president of the Hobart branch. The ALP right eventually forced him out, and in May he formed the Socialist Labour Club with a dozen other revolutionaries. Morale also got a boost with the launch in June of the rank and file metal broadsheet. One of the Monash Revcoms, Kevin Bain, had got a job as a metal worker and later became a shop steward at a Repco plant known for its militancy. Like Clark and Dagger, the broadsheet was mostly distributed outside workplaces by student members. A bit later, another member got a job at a car plant, so, of course, we decided to start producing a car workers' bulletin as well. In July, SWAG adopted a more centralised structure. This was seen as laying the foundations for the national organisation that we hoped would come out of the regroupment discussions. The elected leadership body would have the power to set up or disband branches, to set membership dues and to discipline members, and its decisions could be reviewed or overturned by a general meeting or a conference. In August, we threw ourselves into supporting two important strikes by printers and meat workers. We produced leaflets calling for support and letterboxed them in the House and Commission areas where we sold the Battler, and members spent many hours on picket lines. This experience, plus the hopes of recruitment, significantly revitalised the group. It wasn't all onwards and upwards, though. The La Trobe RevComs folded amid another internal crisis. Our leading activist there, Mick wasn't there anymore by this time, so our leading activist there had taken over running the family business when her father died, and the group felt that being a boss was incompatible with being a swag member. She chose to stick with the business, and the other remaining La Trobe member that resigned with her. The loss of the club was a blow, but like the McHugh dispute beforehand, it did establish certain boundaries. From September, the focus switched to the recruitment discussions. As well as the Marxist, Melbourne Revolutionary Marxists I mentioned, these included two groups of ex-students and workers who were involved with metal workers' union branches in producing bulletins called The Link. But from the outset, divisions emerged between SWAG and the other groups. The MRM in particular was paranoid about what they saw as our imported IS program and insisted that there needed to be a detailed, worked-out program as the basis for fusion. SWAG, on the other hand, argued for unity on the basis of a few key points and while leaving the finer details to be worked out over time. There were also differences over SWAG's rank-and-file strategy in the unions and the other group's preferences for building shop committees. It soon became clear to SWAG that these divisions meant there was no realistic possibility of fusion, and the discussions ended in October. The other groups folded soon after that. By then, too, the Tasmanian group had split, and Rana now led a group called the Workers' League. This only had about six members, but they were highly active and committed. They sold the Battler at factories at the University of Tasmania and on the Hobart Wharves. We'd also been in contact with a group in Canberra, mostly students at the ANU. So a recruitment conference with these two groups was scheduled for early December. Meanwhile, still with only 20 members, SWAG got a bigger office and the Battler went to 12 pages. Thanks. But as we were preparing for the recruitment conference, the constitutional crisis erupted and we were engulfed in frenetic agitational activity. There'd been a wave of industrial action and mass rallies around the country in response to Fraser's threat to block supply. And it looked like he was backing off. So we printed a triumphant issue of the Battler. As you see, against the photo of the Melbourne mass rally and a list of strikes, the headline declared, "This is how we stop Fraser." Then 3 days later, Kerr sacked Whitlam. So we had to pulp that issue. And with a superhuman effort, we got another one put out in time for the four-hour stoppage and mass protest that happened a few days later on November 14th, agitating for a general strike. So about 50,000 people turned out for that protest. We sold over 600 copies of the new paper and hundreds of badges with our slogan, "Strike Fraser Out." One on the wall over there. After a couple of hours of speeches, the Communist Party metal union leader, John Halfpenny, urged the angry crowd to disperse and go home. Instead, thousands of frustrated people milled around, wanting to do something else, but needing a lead. So, as usual, the mouse called for a march on the US consulate. But Griff got hold of a megaphone and urged the crowd to march on the stock exchange, which was just down the road. So we suddenly found ourselves at the head of an angry crowd of about 15,000 people surging down Collins Street. Not a very good photo, but the only one we had. This was a very heady experience, as you can imagine. But of course, our tiny numbers had absolutely no chance of providing an alternative leadership to the Labor and Union leaders. So then on December 6th, about 40 people gathered for the regroupment conference. Discussion on the first day revolved around the strategic orientation that was proposed by SWAG. The building of militant rank-and-file groups within particular workplaces and unions, out of which across-industry rank-and-file movement could grow and eventually lead to the formation of a revolutionary socialist party. So this was adopted as the basis for a new organisation, and 32 of those present signed up for it. The Canberra group didn't, although some of them joined the following year. Rick Coon, for example, joined in 76, Diane Fields in 1977. The next day, the new organisation convened, and after a very lengthy debate, adopted the name International Socialists. Discussion then turned to perspectives for the coming year, 1976. There were three key proposals. First, to begin fortnightly production of the battle. Second, to start building a national organisation. Establishing a branch in Sydney was seen to be absolutely crucial, and we had nothing in the way of contacts there, so it was decided that about half a dozen members would move there. And third was a policy which became known as industrialisation, that is, encouraging ex-student members to get blue-collar jobs with the metals industry as the priority. This was, to say the least, a pretty ambitious perspective for a group of still just over 30 members, and how it all panned out is a topic for another talk. So, to conclude, with hindsight, it's easy to see a lot of things we got wrong. The biggest problem was that we didn't understand that we needed to be building a propaganda group rather than an agitational group. Our strategic orientation was misconceived, and we were looking to entirely the wrong audience. A lot of that is down to the impatience that's an occupational hazard of all small groups. But also you have to remember we were all really young and we were building a new political tendency in Australia completely from scratch. And you also have to remember the urgency of the times. No one foresaw the downturn in struggle that was just on the horizon. Our workerism combined with the focus on agitation meant that student work was downgraded, and this undoubtedly impeded our growth both qualitatively and quantitatively. But there were some pluses. Over the 3 years of SWAG's existence, we developed a high level of agreement around a series of key political questions. The basic elements of the What We Stand For in Red Flag today pretty much worked out back then. And we never contemplated for an instant softening our politics to make it easier to recruit people. We also established and maintained a high level of commitment and activity from our members, which is necessary for small groups to survive. Many other small organisations proliferated in those days, but most of them failed to achieve either political clarity or any form of stable organisation and fell by the wayside. When I was preparing this talk, I asked Tom why he thought we managed to survive. He replied that it was because we were realistic. Now, in the light of what I told you, that might seem a bit weird, given the grandiose tasks that we set ourselves. But I think there's a really important element of truth to it. Through all the ups and downs, we did keep our feet on the ground most of the time. When we bit off more than we could chew, which was frequently, we were able to retreat and consolidate without imploding. We weathered some serious internal crises and tried to learn from our experiences. And we never kidded ourselves that we were more than we actually were, a very small group, albeit one with big ideas. And really, we're still that today, and we have no illusions about the magnitude of the challenges that face us. But the lessons and experiences from the SWAG years, I think, are a valuable part of our journey. Thanks.